From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. President Trump apparently stunned even close advisors with his announcement U.S. forces will pull back from northern Syria. How might that affect the U.S.'s ally, the Kurds? Also, our political analysts consider the state of the 2020 field, from Bernie Sanders' health to Joe Biden's lackluster fundraising and the continued rise of Elizabeth Warren. We'll get to it after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. If you were out yesterday for the KPCC open house, I hope you had a wonderful day. From the Ask a Reporter booth to the tours of the station, even see the studio where we do Air Talk every day, and the live events that we did in our Crawford Family Forum. If you were out for the noon conversation that I led with our reporters, it was great to have you there. Thanks so much. If you missed it, there'll be a chance next year, and we hope you'll come visit us at our Pasadena studios. Next week, the California Coastal Commission is scheduled to consider the North San Diego County City of Del Mar's plan for coping with rising sea level. The commission wants to require cities to buy vulnerable beachside property and relocate the residents who are there. Del Mar says it can't afford that and is planning to protect its bluff-top homes. Next hour, we'll look at the implications for other coastal property. But first, it's our weekly political analysis. We begin with the surprising announcement by President Trump that U.S. forces will pull back from northern Syria. That's bringing widespread condemnation, including from close allies of the president. What's the risk of reward in leaving the Kurds to deal with Turkey? Joining us to talk about the surprising announcement, Greg Myrie, NPR national security correspondent. Greg, thank you for joining us. First of all, was there anyone who seemed to be anticipating this announcement?
Well, no, it caught a lot of people by surprise, and we're still trying to figure out exactly what is happening here. President Trump had a phone conversation on Sunday with Turkey's President Erdogan, and then late Sunday night, the White House put out a statement saying it would not interfere if Turkish troops came into northern Syria, where the U.S. forces are based, along with the Kurds. The president began tweeting this morning saying, it's time for us to get out of these ridiculous, endless wars, many of them tribal, and bring our soldiers home. So it appeared quite suddenly and surprisingly, the president was going to take out these 1,000 or so American forces in this area, but we're getting more and more confused as we hear from the State Department and the Pentagon.
We just heard Senator Lindsey Graham, a supporter of President Trump, blister him in that Fox and Friends phone interview this morning. But Greg, let's step back a moment, talk about what those 1,000 U.S. forces are doing. What's their role right now in northern Syria?
Right. So U.S. forces have been in northeastern Syria for about 5 years now, working with Kurdish militias. They helped defeat ISIS. That was their main role there, and they were quite effective. And now that that's over, the president has been saying, or now that ISIS has been beaten back and lost its self-proclaimed state or caliphate, the president keeps talking about wanting to bring the U.S. troops home. But he's getting a lot of pushback, even within his own administration. When he went public with this last December, this is when his defense secretary, Jim Mattis, resigned. And so he backed off a little bit, and the president said, well, we'll keep 1,000 troops there. And these 1,000 troops, a small presence, but they have been helping, along with the Kurds, maintaining stability there in northeastern Syria. And there's other unresolved issues. One of the biggest, these Kurds are holding several thousand ISIS prisoners, and other countries don't want to take their citizen ISIS fighters from their countries back. And so what's going to happen to these ISIS fighters? So a lot of unresolved questions here.
President Trump has said that those countries of origin for the ISIS fighters should be required to take them back, but it seems like there's no movement in that direction. So what are the fears, Greg, if the U.S. does remove the 1,000 American troops that are there, the fear that Turkey is just going to go in and waylay the Kurds?
Exactly. The Turks see these Kurds as anti-Turkish terrorists, and they've been itching to sort of go in and create this zone along the border, maybe 20 miles deep into Syria and 300 miles wide across the border, take control of that to prevent any possible attacks in Turkey. So what the Turks see as a real threat, the U.S. sees as a real ally who's effectively helped them defeat ISIS. And this could turn an area that's been not resolved politically, but at least relatively stable for the past year and a half, into a real free-for-all. Because you'd have Turkish troops coming into Syria. You have the Syrian army may not like this. We don't know how they would respond. And the Kurds squeezed in the middle. And the U.S. may be leaving or may not. Again, as I said, it's in contrast to the president's tweets, the Pentagon and the State Department are saying they're making it clear they don't support a Turkish operation in Syria.
Greg Myrie with us, NPR national security correspondent. The president, of course, had campaigned on pulling back U.S. involvement in the region, talking about endless wars that America carries out. And, Greg, he tweeted to that effect, tying into that campaign promise. And is that the thought that as the impeachment inquiry continues and members of his administration have been subpoenaed, that this is an effort to go back and to say, I promise this, I'm going to follow through?
Yeah, it certainly fits with what he said on the campaign trail in 2016 and since taking office. But he keeps getting some pushback, again, from his own national security advisors, as well as top Republicans. As you've mentioned, Lindsey Graham, Mitt Romney, Mike Huckabee have all said this is a really bad idea. And so there's in the national security community, there's been real resistance from former of top officials. And as we saw, General Mattis resign. Just last week, Joe Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, finished his term. So he was ready to step down. But he'd been a supporter of keeping a U.S. presence there. So you have somebody new stepping in, Mark Milley, who just walked in last week to this position. And it seems that this may be a case where the president has decided now that some of the people that really opposed me are gone, I've decided to move ahead with this now.
Greg, I know you're working on deadline. Really appreciate your taking the time in the middle of all this is trying to answer many of these questions that we're all asking. Anything just briefly to add before I let you go?
Well, again, the president has been tweeting, and so we're seeing some very strange things. The president just tweeted recently that he said, quote, if Turkey does anything that I, in my great and unmatched wisdom, consider to be off limits, I will totally destroy and obliterate the economy of Turkey, close quote. Turkey is a NATO member, has been a longtime U.S. ally. He just had a conversation with the president yesterday, and this tweet is quite striking, threatening to destroy the Turkish economy.
Certainly some head-scratching here. Greg Myrie, national security correspondent for NPR, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Let's also get an update on the very latest with the impeachment inquiry of the House of Representatives. Joining us from Bloomberg, politics editor Anna Edgerton. Anna, thank you for being with us. Where do we stand with the efforts of these multiple House committees to get members of the Trump administration to testify?
Yeah, so the House and Senate are in recess this week, so members are back in their states and districts, talking to constituents, trying to take the temperature a little bit of where their voters are on the issue of impeachment. But meanwhile, like you said, the House committees are still here in Washington working on the impeachment inquiry. They have scheduled a lineup of depositions of current and former State Department officials, some associates of Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's personal attorney, and they're trying to move ahead with this process so that it doesn't lose momentum while lawmakers are out of town, and so they can keep on accumulating information that will feed into, you know, possibly eventual articles of impeachment.
Now, there was word over the weekend that an attorney representing, I believe it's the original whistleblower, says now the attorneys representing whistleblowers, plural. What do we know about that additional individual or individuals?
that was a really interesting development over the weekend. And we don't know a whole lot about this individual or what he or she knows. But one thing we do know is that he or she has firsthand information, as opposed to the original whistleblower who had secondhand information of this July 25th phone call between President Trump and the president of Ukraine. And the original whistleblower, it sounded like it kind of acted like an aggregator of all of this information that had come from people within the White House and people who had actually listened to or been familiar with this call. So it'll be interesting to see if firsthand information from a second whistleblower can corroborate some of that beyond the rough transcript that the White House has already published. It will be even more interesting to see if this second whistleblower can point to a pattern of behavior, and then the president has had similar conversations with other foreign leaders or kind of behave similarly in different situations and can bring additional allegations to add to the concerns about this Ukraine call.
Anna, we also had a federal judge's decision this morning that New York State could continue to pursue the last several years of tax returns for President Trump. Presumably, the president's going to be appealing that. Would this go to a district appellate court, or what will we be looking at next?
There was a stay on that so that the president doesn't have to immediately comply. But this will be a really interesting development to see how it plays into not only the legal battle, but also the political battle. Because one thing House Democrats are trying to decide right now is what to include in the scope of impeachment articles. So if they want to keep the scope very narrow and try to move more quickly, they're going to focus just on these Ukraine allegations. But there are other committees who have been working on different investigations regarding President Trump and his associates and business dealings, including the Ways and Means Committee, which is the committee responsible for taxes, which has been looking into the president's tax returns and some of his financial transactions. So if Ways and Means Chairman Richie Neal ends up going after these tax returns and using this New York case to get some of that information, that could even play into how Democrats approach an eventual impeachment of the president.
There was the president last week also asking China to look into what he said was corrupt dealings of Joe and his son Hunter Biden involving Chinese entities. Has there been any sorts of response to that beyond just condemning the president for making that statement?
It was fascinating to see last week how Republicans and Democrats looked at the same words from the president and came to totally different conclusions. You know, Democrats looked at it and said, he's doing it again. He's saying out loud things that are an impeachable offense. You know, he's asking a foreign power to, in effect, interfere in the 2020 election, according to Democrats. Republicans, on the other hand, kind of brushed it off as Trump being Trump, kind of, you know, speaking out loud in a off-the-cuff way to reporters. You even had Senator Marco Rubio of Florida say, you know, he thought the president was joking, that he wasn't really serious. So, you know, it's another example of the rough transcript from the Ukraine call is another one, and how you have Republicans and Democrats looking at the exact same words and coming to very different conclusions about what they mean.
Yeah, it's funny because there have been times where I thought the president was joking, and I thought media didn't quite, you know, give him a break on that. I didn't hear any joking in the China comment. That seemed very he seemed very serious to me when he made that point. So it's interesting to hear Marco Rubio say he thought he was joking there. Anna, thank you so much. Appreciate your talking with us and updating us on the latest.
Glad to be here.
Anna Edgerton, politics editor at Bloomberg. Coming up, we'll hear from our political analysts what they think about some of the latest developments, including Syria, the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. We'll talk with Amanda Renteria. She's the president of Emerge America. And Lonnie Chen, Stanford University's Hoover Institution Research Fellow. You're listening to Where Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in just 1 minute. Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk. Coming up in our second hour, we have a fascinating case involving California Coastal Commission and the North San Diego County city of Del Mar. They're at odds over how to deal with sea level rise. The California Coastal Commission stand is that as the sea level rises, that whatever erosion or flooding problems that causes, cities, instead of trying to mitigate the effects, should retreat from those areas, buy up the properties that are threatened, relocate people that live along the coast. Del Mar says we can't afford to do that. Those properties are too expensive, and we're going to do what we can to try and mitigate the effect of sea level rise on those blufftop properties. So they're headed to a showdown at the Coastal Commission meeting next week. We're going to preview that for you coming up a little bit later on Air Talk. But right now, my pleasure to introduce our political analyst from the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, research fellow Lonnie Chen. He advised the Marco Rubio 2016 presidential campaign. Lonnie, let me start with you. Since you worked with Senator Rubio on his campaign, Your thoughts about him characterizing President Trump's China investigation comment as a joke?
Well, I think obviously Senator Rubio has had his share of comments about the president, some favorable, some unfavorable. You know, he read it as a joke. I didn't. And I think a lot of other people probably didn't as well. But it'll be interesting to see. You know, Marco Rubio and the president have had some disagreements on matters of foreign policy. Maybe we'll get into that a little bit when we talk about the Syria situation. But I don't think Senator Rubio has been someone who has been shy to express policy disagreements with the president when he has felt a need to.
Amanda Renteria, president of Emerge America, which identifies and trains Democratic women to run for political office. She was national political director for Hillary Clinton's last presidential campaign and has been a staffer for major senators. Good to have you with us again, Amanda. Let's talk Syria. And what do you make of President Trump's tweet about withdrawal?
You know, I know we've talked about this before on this show, and I've said the same line every single time is the scariness of his impulsive behaviors. I mean, when you think about how world leaders behave and how the President of the United States is supposed to behave, it's supposed to be collaborative and thoughtful. And I think what we're seeing here is not only was there no collaboration with partners around the world, but even in Congress with some of his allies who are usually right there within minutes to support him, you're just seeing people step away and begin to realize the seriousness of his impulsive actions when it comes to foreign policies, but just in general, it's beginning to add up. And so it's obviously very concerning. I mean, seeing Senator Graham immediately post some very, very clear statements about the need to really think through these actions, I think is an important telltale sign of what is happening within the Republican Party and in our leadership.
Well, he didn't pull any punches, did he? And in that interview this morning, he was just bold against the president and the action there, and he's been one of his staunchest supporters. Let me go back to Lonnie Chen on this. Lonnie, your thoughts about Syria and what would be behind the president's announcement of this?
Yeah, the president has long been kind of had this non-interventionist streak. He's had this isolationist streak that frankly, has been appealing, I think, to some Democrats and libertarians. People like Rand Paul, for example, have cheered the president's decision in this regard. But it has run him afoul of what Republicans traditionally, national security conservatives, believe is the right policy. And here again, we have an example of that. You have seen the president's policy to pull back in Syria, to pull back from our support of the Kurdish rebels in Syria. You've seen criticism of that from Marco Rubio, from Lindsey Graham, from Mitt Romney, from Nikki Haley even, his former UN ambassador. And I think the reason you see that criticism is because the policy is short-sighted. The policy does not evince an understanding that ISIS can reconfigure and reform itself very quickly. And also, you know, this is a very troubled region. And the notion that, you know, we'll just let folks out there sort it out, I think is going to result in some real calamity for folks in the region and potentially for the United States. So that's why you see a lot of Republicans coming out against this. And frankly, it's a short-sighted a policy that hopefully the president will reverse course on.
Well, and you mentioned Nikki Haley, the former UN ambassador, and she had a hashtag on her tweet. I'm trying to find it, but I can't. Something like, you know, Turkey is not our friend or something like that, which I thought was a little surprising.
Well, yeah, you know, the Turks have been, you know, they've engaged in some behavior, obviously, that that has been challenging for us at the very least. And, you know, nonetheless, they are a NATO ally. They are an important force in the region, given the geographic location, but also the politics of Turkey. So I think it's a challenging region. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it's completely black and white. And I think the president has reason to be concerned about entanglements where the U.S. is sort of in an open-ended situation. Nonetheless, there are reasons for us to be there. There are reasons for us to be supportive of the Kurds in particular. And so, yeah, this is a big challenge. It's a tough region to deal with, and glib tweets don't oftentimes cover what we need to express.
I actually found that Nikki Haley tweet says, "We must always have the backs of our allies if we expect them to have our back. The Kurds were instrumental in our successful fight against ISIS in Syria. Leaving them to die is a big mistake. Hashtag Turkey is not our friend." That's former U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley. We're talking politics with Lonnie Chen of Stanford's Hoover Institution. Amanda Renteria is the president of Emerge America, which identifies and works with Democratic women to run for political office. We're talking about President Trump's announcement about Syria and the withdrawal of the 1,000-strong U.S. force in northern Syria, where they're working with the Kurds. Also, the latest on the impeachment inquiry. Amanda, let me come back to you on the impeachment inquiry here. And with the president not being clear about what he will allow in terms of White House staffers to testify or not before House committees, if there's an impasse here, what do you anticipate, you know, coming from that?
You know, I think we're going to continue to see the different committees move forward with the interviews they can do and learn as much as they can. And, you know, just this past week, having Kurt Volker in there with 8 hours, 60 pages of texts, that gives committees a lot to work with in this time, a lot of different interviews to have. But I don't see this going away. And I see Democrats who are leading these committee efforts pushing even more. And I think what we're also seeing is the seriousness of the conversations that have been happening, which people are very concerned on the Democratic side that we are going to see something happen in 2020 in terms of interference with foreign governments and really start to see a lot more of what we were seeing in 2016, but didn't know it with Russia. And I am beginning to hear a lot more conversations of the importance of this impeachment, importance of this inquiry, based on the fact that we need to make sure we have a fair and free election in 2020. So I don't see this stopping, even though the president would like to slow it down and stop it if he could.
What do you see, Lonnie, as where this ultimately goes? And do you think that the senators are at all open if there's additional evidence of questionable ethical conduct by the president that you might actually get the Senate to be willing to remove?
I'm doubtful of that. I do think it's important to recognize a few things. First of all, impeachment is a political process, not a legal one. And in that sense, what will motivate people in making decisions in the Senate or otherwise is fundamentally politics. And that's why, you know, people have said, well, look, who in the Senate might potentially be open to voting for conviction? And the answer is, to the extent there are Republicans who believe their electoral fortunes are somewhat tied to being more taking a firmer stand against the president, then that could suggest that these are people who could come over. But even then, I think it's very, very difficult. You have a very polarized electorate. You have a very polarized Congress and a very shirts and skins kind of attitude amongst Republicans and Democrats. And that is the primary driver of all of this, I think. And that's why at the end of the day, I'm still skeptical that you see Republicans come around in the Senate to voting to convict if indeed that that vote comes to them.
So what you'd have to see for them to make that shift would be significant erosion among Republicans in their support for the president.
Yeah, I mean, look, as long as the president continues to maintain strong approval ratings with his base, it's going to be very challenging, I think, for Republicans to to step out against him. And I think that's just the reality of where we are in the politics of this.
Amanda, I wanted to ask you about what the effect has been on Joe Biden with President Trump hammering about Hunter Biden's work for the Ukrainian-based company, serving on its board, making significant income from that. Joe Biden just there have been Democrats very critical of the way that he's responded to that. Do you think that there are ways he could be more effective in pushing back?
I do. I think, you know, I think a lot of the criticism that is out there, I think, is pretty fair in terms of here's his moment. People are watching. What is he going to do? How is he standing up to this moment? And, you know, just having seen him over the course of his career, I know the family stuff. I know that personal attack actually hits him in a different way. And I think as he thinks about, his campaign thinks about these next really few days, that really figuring out how are you now going to go on offense and make sure that you're taking this moment to remind people the seriousness of what we are in today. And although it does wrap up his family and everything happening, I know that's difficult from a personal level. Now is the time to think about leading this country. And I think at this very moment, we need to make sure that we have a leader who is ready to stand up to what is happening and have not just moral courage, but moral outrage about what is happening. And I think that's the piece that people aren't seeing from Vice President Biden. But listen, there's going to be a lot of time for this. There's no doubt with the ads that folks are trying to put out there that the president is continuing to push on. Vice President Biden's going to have a lot more moments to respond, and we'll see how his campaign shapes and how he shapes in this response as well.
Man,
but I got to tell you, everybody's watching this.
Yeah, and Amanda, it seems to you one of the challenges is how to respond. So Joe Biden can make the argument, look, my son didn't do anything wrong. There's no evidence that, you know, there's that aside from the salary that he took, there was any you know, double dealing here, or that I was acting to protect him or on his behalf. The problem I think that Joe Biden faces is the sort of, you know, the appearance of a conflict of interest here, and everybody, you know, thinking that, well, Hunter Biden was hired for this job because the idea is to try and insulate, you know, the company from any investigation or going after it. And so the problem is how does he effectively defend against, you know, what even a lot of Democrats aren't all that comfortable with?
You know, I think one of the lessons learned is you do have to repeat that this investigation has happened and nothing was found here. Repeat it over and over and over again, and then pivot to what's really going on and make sure to take the time to educate folks about what this president is doing. I mean, one of the things that I take away from this moment of China is how many times I heard over the weekend Republicans saying, he's just joking. That was exactly what people said in 2016. And then come to find out intelligence agencies after their investigative report verified that, in fact, the Russians did interfere. And so we've got to make sure that we are learning the lessons of the past. And certainly Biden, Vice President Biden, knows this well. And it is important for him to do everything he can to both address it quickly, but then also educate folks on what's really happening here in this presidential election and not let another repeat of 2016 happen where foreign countries enter into our democracy.
Lonnie, how would you respond if you were Joe Biden, or how would you advise him?
Well, I do think he needs to be forceful in articulating the facts. I think he needs to be forceful in, you know, if he doesn't have anything to hide, he should not appear as though he does. I think he needs to be fully transparent and forceful in that regard. And I do think that the challenge for him is the muddying of the waters. I mean, that is something the president has done very well, not just with Biden, but with other candidates and other political adversaries as well, which is to create some kind of equivalence or to somehow figure out a way to make things such that you're wrestling in the mud. And, you know, I think the president's very comfortable he can win that fight. I'm not sure Joe Biden's demonstrated that he's comfortable and can win that fight. So I think to a certain degree, this is about conveying information, but more importantly, it's about an attitude. It's about demonstrating a readiness to compete with the president at that level. And I'm just not sure Biden's done that yet.
But of course, you know, Marco Rubio with his, you know, hands comment, tried to sort of, you know, do to Trump what Trump was doing to other candidates, and that backfired terribly.
Yeah, but it's not about calling people names. It's about an attitude and a posture more than anything else.
We'll continue our conversation with Lonnie Chen of Stanford's Hoover Institution, Amanda Renteria of Emerge America. So much more to talk about, from politics, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders' health, of course, and the rise of Elizabeth Warren. We'll be back after a live update from Hedy Lyn Hurdies. Wonderful to have you with us today on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Ahead in our second hour, we're going to look at homeless Angelenos. You know, the LA Homeless Services organization does a census where they try and determine how many people are unhoused in Los Angeles. And one of the challenges also is finding out what are their needs beyond not having a place to live. What is the degree of substance abuse challenges or mental health challenges that those individuals might have? We're going to talk about how you try and determine that. And is there a particularly reliable way of getting that information? Because then much of that has to do with how you deploy services to try and help those in need in Southern California. That's our second hour here on Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Well, I was watching the National League Division series on television yesterday when this ad, which was placed by the Trump campaign, aired.
Joe Biden promised Ukraine $1 billion if they fired the prosecutor investigating his son's company.
If the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money. Oh, son of a bitch. Got fired.
But when President Trump asks Ukraine to investigate corruption, the Democrats want to impeach him, and their media lapdogs fall in line. They lost the election. Now they want to steal this one. Don't let them.
I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
CNN refused to run that Trump campaign ad, said it didn't meet its advertising standards. A CNN spokesperson told The Hollywood Reporter that in addition to disparaging CNN and its journalists, the ad makes assertions that have been proven demonstrably false by various news outlets, including CNN. Lonnie Chen, let me start with you on that one. Your thoughts about the ad and CNN's refusal to carry it?
Yeah, I mean, the ad is it's pretty striking for a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, to be clear, I think over the years, many political campaigns have taken liberties in how they put ads together and the facts they represent in ads. It would be quite another thing, of course, to have outright falsehoods in ads, but certainly I think what we're seeing is an escalation of the fight between, first of all, the media and the Trump team, which is obviously, by the way, a battle that the Trump folks think inures to their benefit. The reason that they continue to return to this thematic around the media and conflict with the media is because the base of Trump voters, the people who support the president, who the president needs, by the way, to show up to vote next year, are very animated by this. And frankly, conservatives and Republicans generally over the years have been frustrated with what they perceive as media bias. And so I think this clearly goes to that theme. But beyond that, in terms of CNN's response, you know, I understand why CNN's doing what it's doing. But in effect, what it's also doing is it's giving the Trump team yet another opening to criticize the media, to say, look, they won't even run our ad. This is how patently unfair this whole process is. So it's very interesting to see the process by which the campaign decides to go ahead with this thematic and then how CNN responds. And in some ways, I think the media does inadvertently fuel the fan the flames, if you will, of the conflict and the fire between conservatives and the media itself.
Well, and I don't. It may have been a local ad buy, so it might not have been that TBS, the network, had anything to do with it. But TBS and CNN are co-owned, which was funny that I'm seeing it there on a channel that's owned by the same parent company. We're talking as well with Amanda Renteria of Emerge America. Amanda, how's that ad strike you?
Lonnie's right. Some of these things happen in campaigns across the country over the years, and there has been an escalation, and this takes it to a whole new level. You know, one of my concerns as I see this, and we're actually seeing this in real time, is that everyone is going to have their moment of being tested. And sometimes there is no good answer. And so CNN sees something like this. What do you do? Do you air it or you don't? Both will be criticized. And I think at the end of the day, we are going to see institution after institution, leader after leader, go through the moment where they look themselves in the mirror and say, here is what I'm going to do because I think this is the best way forward, but I know it's still going to be criticized. And that's how I look at this moment with CNN, which is no matter what they did, they would have had some problems against them. At the end of the day, you do have to look in the mirror and say, how am I contributing to a better democracy in this country? And I think their answer was right this time around.
We talked earlier about Joe Biden, and it does seem that he's getting nicked up at the very least with the impeachment inquiry and Ukraine being at the center of it. But let's talk about the other candidates. Amanda, your thoughts about Bernie Sanders with the heart attack he suffered last week, the two stents that he had inserted. He's out of the hospital. He has said he will be at next Tuesday's CNN New York Times debate. You know, in the past, I would have thought a heart attack would have almost certainly, particularly at the age of Bernie Sanders, made him non-viable as a candidate. I'm not sure that's necessarily true these days. What do you think?
I think when you have 3 million donors ready to give a couple of bucks, I think that keeps you around in this campaign for quite a bit of time. But listen, I also think that the escalating news that we are seeing, the intensity of this news with Trump and really also going after Biden, I think you are going to start to see Democrats say, okay, let's get to a smaller number on the stage. Let's start to really figure out where we're going to go as a party in this primary election, and let's make sure we're not hurting each other. And so I suspect that this last week will bring the field a little bit closer. But, you know, listen, you still have Senator Warren emerging. She is certainly showing numbers and a consistent, steady pace. Sanders, of course, has a great following and they are still there despite the heart attack. And I suspect they will be helping as he gets on that debate stage. Biden, of course, is one of the front runners. And then you're seeing what's going to happen in the next tier. Will Senator Harris pop up? Will Senator Booker pop up? Will Mayor Pete continue to rise as he has been? And so it is going to be an interesting set over this next 30 to 60 days, because I feel a certain unsettling within the Democratic Party saying we need to figure out who our candidate is, or at least have a smaller platform so we can hear everybody and distinguish the differences.
We have seven candidates, by the way, who have qualified for the November debate, 12 candidates in next week's, which I just wonder, what the potential benefit, or if people are even going to tune in with 12 candidates on stage. But the November debate, the criteria become stricter for qualification. You have to have 3% in a fixed number of polls and 165,000 individual donors. Those are the dual thresholds. So seven candidates have qualified. No surprise that you've got Biden, Warren, Sanders, Harris, Buttigieg. In addition to that, Booker and Steyer have also qualified under those criteria. So seven currently in on the November, but next week's with 12 candidates. Lonnie, it's again going to be very challenging for any one candidate to get enough time to make his or her case.
It is, by definition, when you have that many candidates, you're talking about, maybe a few minutes of talk time per candidate. And really, it's not a debate. It is about kind of making a point or trying to have a moment. And I think that that's always challenging. What I'll say is, you know, there will be some who will criticize the media outlets for drawing a tighter field as we get toward November and December. I think that's absolutely the right thing to do, because you want to begin to winnow this field. You want the voters want to be able to hear from the 6, 7, you know, 8 candidates who are most likely to be the nominee of the Democratic Party. And at some point, tough choices do have to be made. So candidates, a few candidates who are on the fringes who are always going to complain about not making the debates. But the reality is, if you're not polling at a certain level, by the time we get to November, you probably ought to pack it up and go home. And so it's for the best that the field is narrowed.
We'll continue our conversation with Lonnie Chen and Amanda Renteria. We'll be talking about Elizabeth Warren's continued rise, quite the fundraising haul. She continues to show strong in the polling in the early states where there are caucuses and primaries. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Next hour on Air Talk, California's effort to fight so-called deep fake videos, particularly around elections. The state legislature passed a law signed by Governor Newsom, which allows for civil action to be taken, an effort to recoup damages by candidates who feel they're unfairly harmed by deep fake videos, which portray them doing things they didn't really do or saying things they didn't really say. But what are the chances to really recoup under the new law? We'll find out next hour here on Air Talk. Right now, we're talking with political analyst Amanda Renteria of Emerge America and Hoover Institution research fellow Lonnie Chen. Hoover is on the Stanford campus. We're talking about the 2020 field of Democratic candidates at this point. Lonnie, with the strengthening of Elizabeth Warren, and if she is able to pick up more of Bernie Sanders' support going forward, there are Democrats who are concerned, I know, about her ability to beat Trump in a head-to-head race. What are your thoughts about that?
I think the concern is very real. If I were a Democrat, I would be concerned about Elizabeth Warren, not so much because of her, you know, who she is, more because of the positions I think she's taken during this primary campaign. And some of that will be challenging for her to walk back in a general election. And I think that's probably the biggest issue. So for Democrats, then the question is, if Warren is the more likely nominee, and if she represents the progressive wing of the party, who will carry the banner for the more moderate wing of the party if Joe Biden is as damaged as we discussed earlier? You know, will it be Pete Buttigieg? Will it be somebody else who's in the field now or someone who's not in the field now? And I think that's the reason why people are beginning to hand-wring a little bit, because if you don't have a moderate alternative, you're going to end up with someone who I do think, by virtue of the position she's taken, have a more difficult road to beating Donald Trump next November than someone who has taken positions that allow a little more wiggle room or who are a little bit more moderate.
But Amanda, it just seems like if Kamala Harris is that candidate, you know, she's just struggling to gain traction with voters. She does not seem to be interpersonally connecting with them. Buttigieg seems to have the personality with that opportunity. Do you think that there is someone poised to be that moderate alternative to Biden?
I think we still have some time to see some of these candidates. It's the reason why we're all hoping for a smaller number of folks on the stage so that you can get to know people a little bit more and they can have their moments. But I still think that there is a shot for one of these, you know, top 8, 7 candidates, for one of them to sort of rise and bring a new voice to it. But it is pretty difficult right now, I have to admit, in the primary process to get a lot of attention, not only because of what is happening in the Trump administration, but because the conversation is so intense
And really, Elizabeth Warren and her plans have taken up quite a bit of oxygen in the room, along with Biden. And can he step up to this moment? And then, of course, you have Sanders, who is always out there rallying folks up. So it is really tough to break into this primary process and really offer sort of a middle of the road, stronger together kind of message. And I think some of that is the electorate wants to hear the intensity around the issues right now. And that doesn't lend itself to moderate ideas.
Well, and the other thing is that Warren, I would argue, has been such a compelling candidate personally. Her debating skills, her consistently high-energy presentation at the rallies that she does. She's proven herself to be a very formidable candidate. I understand what Lonnie's saying about, you know, her policies so far to the left that in a general election it's going to make it tough for her. But it's understandable how she's been able to rise within the Democratic Party, Amanda.
Yeah, I think there's two things here. One, she has proven to be able to be in the ring, not only in this primary process, but she's taken on very big interests like Wall Street. Secondly, and I think this is one of the things that's been under-talked about, is this ability to explain complex ideas and policies in a really simplified kind of way, connecting to the working class families out there. Her ability to do that is remarkable, and she's been doing it over the course of her career, and I think that gives her a real edge should she move forward, because she does have this ability to connect with your working class folks out there. I've been in the room. I've seen it. You see it happening, and that piece of it, I think we're going to see more of over time, and people are going to begin to understand, and it does open up the ability to educate folks who might be a little bit more concerned about her policies going forward.
I just wonder about the ability, you know, because we have such a significant cultural divide in the country. If the economic plans that she has, if that's the inroad with sort of, you know, middle America, if she can still overcome the cultural hurdle there, what do you think, Lonnie?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, I think she has met a moment to a certain degree in terms of her policy proposals. And you know, being a policy person myself, I appreciate that she's focused on that. And I think it does start a dialogue to the extent we can ever have one about policy. I don't know whether that policy, whether being able to connect with this populist moment sort of takes over or supplants the fact that there might be these cultural differences that come from the fact that she's a blue state senator from not just a blue state, but arguably one of the bluest of states in Massachusetts, and how that impacts her ability to connect with voters, let's say, in places like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. Is the policy going to be enough? And I think that is the million-dollar question for Elizabeth Warren. And to a certain degree, the primary process is interesting, but it allows us to test that theory and see how well she is actually connecting in some of these parts of the country where culturally her background might not be a great fit.
I wanted to ask you about the Supreme Court, which begins its term today, because, Lonnie, that has been at the center of Republican support for President Trump because of the conservative justices that he's been able to nominate and have confirmed. You think that the court and, you know, some of the cases it's taking on, could it all be a factor in the 2020 race?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think a lot of people, if you ask them why they stick with Donald Trump, they will give you chapter and verse on all the reasons they don't like him. But they will say, look, he has kept his commitment to nominate justices to the Supreme Court and judges to the appellate courts who respect the Constitution and the rule of law. And that is what you hear over and over again. And with the kinds of cases the Supreme Court will take up this term, cases involving LGBT rights, abortion, DACA, a big hot button topics, these will be significant reasons for Republicans to stay with the president, even if they find his personal conduct odious.
Want to thank you both so much for being with us. That's Lonnie Chen, Hoover Institution at Stanford, where he's research fellow, and he was an advisor for the Rubio 2016 campaign and policy director for Mitt Romney's 2012 presidential run. Amanda Renteria is the president of Emerge America, which identifies and trains Democratic women to run for office, former national political director for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us today. We have a lot of big topics coming up in the second hour, which I'll tell you about momentarily. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. If you were with us yesterday for our KPCC open house, I hope you had a wonderful time. It's sure fun for us to be able to meet listeners who come to see the workings at KPCC, getting tours of our studios. I know a lot of folks came by here where we do Air Talk, got a chance to see the beautiful facility. What's really wild is seeing it fully populated with people just, you know, working hard, bringing you the show each day. I'm just the tip of the iceberg of all the different support that goes on. But great to have you with us. And if you missed it, make sure you come in 2020 when we do our next open house. Well, cities along the California coast are trying to figure out how to deal with the rising sea level. If it's communities that are atop bluffs, erosion, of course, is the problem. We've seen Northern California, city of Pacifica, have to deal with that, where a whole condominium complex had to be demolished because of eroding cliffside on which it sat. You've also got low-lying areas, which are going to be prone to flooding. And then the question is, do you construct berms or seawalls or other things to try and protect those properties? The California Coastal Commission has come out with its general policy that it's best to retreat from those areas as opposed to, you know, putting all kinds of, you know, millions or billions of dollars into mitigation measures. But for the North San Diego County City of Del Mar, they're not so quick to say they're willing to retreat. With us is environmental reporter at our fellow NPR member station, KPBS San Diego, Eric Anderson. Eric, good to have you with us again.
Well, thank you, Larry. I appreciate it.
So next week, Del Mar takes its case to the State Coastal Commission. What is Del Mar proposing to do to deal with its bluffside properties?
Well, what Del Mar, you know, Del Mar actually has two problems. It's not just bluffside properties. It's the other problem, too. They have some low-lying areas as well. And what Del Mar has been working on for the last decade or so is a local coastal plan that would allow them to deal with some of the changing environmental conditions. That means higher sea levels. Higher sea levels, of course, put more pressure on bluffs. They can erode, undercut there. They also create more flooding instances in lower-lying areas. And Del Mar has both of those conditions, and the plan was designed to kind of lay a roadmap for the city to deal with both of those conditions. One of the early discussions that they had there was this idea of managed retreat, basically moving back away from the threat that's being created by these changing climate conditions. But the thing about Del Mar is that the entire city of about 4,400 people is already completely built out, and it's very expensive property. The bluffside, the blufftop homes are you know, very expensive homes. They overlook the ocean.
Of dollars, I'm sure.
Multi-million-dollar homes. The lower coastal, low-lying neighborhood that it's being threatened by sea level rise is also very expensive homes. And what the city decided early on was that they couldn't really afford to buy these properties back from the homeowners. They just don't have the resources for that. And so what they've wanted to do is kind of try to buffer some of the changes by bolstering the beaches, for example, putting extra sand, creating a bigger buffer, and then as the sea level rises, sort of dealing with it as it goes. The Coastal Commission, not entirely happy with that plan. In fact, they've recommended some pretty big changes in what the Del Mar city officials have come up with. They've recommended 25 addendums before they'll approve the local coastal plan for the city of Del Mar. And those include things like looking at where the flood zones are, where the coastal bluffs are, where the sea level rise is going to have an impact, having these. So one of the controversial items is having these trigger clauses in the plan so that when a certain condition is met, another condition happens. The city would be responsible for dealing with it on that level. And so it's some pretty sweeping changes that aren't going over well, terribly well, with the local folks in Del Mar.
And does the Coastal Commission, Eric, do they rule supreme over this zone that's close to the shoreline, and can they tell cities what to do?
Well, rule supreme, I don't know if we can kind of call that, but they do have jurisdiction within 3 miles of the coast, right? And this is a development plan, which is kind of ironic because Del Mar is completely built out. There's not going to be any development of new land, but this plan would guide development moving into the future. So if there was a redevelopment, say for example, some properties were, some houses were torn down to create a larger apartment building, for example, just as an example, the local coastal plan would determine how that was handled and what guidelines the city of Del Mar would use to develop a project or redevelop a project like that.
Eric Anderson, environmental reporter for our fellow NPR member station, KPBS San Diego, with us. He's been covering this story of the North San Diego County city of Del Mar for some time now. We invited a representative of the State Coastal Commission to join us. They were not able to provide anybody, but with us to provide an environmental perspective on mitigation measures. Jennifer Savage is California Policy Manager for the nonprofit, the Surfrider Foundation. Ms. Savage, thank you very much for being with us. What's the rationale behind managed retreat as opposed to, you know, building bigger seawalls and berms and more sand and all these things to try and stave off sea level rise?
Hi, thanks. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on, Larry. I really appreciate it. And in response to your question, you know, the driving question behind everything that the Coastal Commission does and what the Coastal Act is all about and what applies to not only Del Mar, but throughout the state is who do the beaches belong to? You know, do the beaches belong to private property owners or do the beaches belong to the public? And because we live in California, thank goodness, the beaches belong to the public. And so the problem with seawalls and other types of hard armoring, such as covering bluffs in concrete, it means that you're taking the public's beach away because it makes the beach erode even faster. We already know that we're going to lose most of our beaches in Southern California due to sea level rise. And so we should be doing everything possible to preserve them for the public. You know, there's over 2 million people who visit Del Mar every year. And those people, the beach belongs to them as much as it does anybody else.
So Del Mar's plan to replenish sand and to continue to, you know, bring in truckloads of sand, you don't think that that would effectively protect the beach for visitors?
Sand replenishment is not a long-term solution. I mean, there's a lot of complications that come along, you know. Just sand as a resource is actually fairly scarce. And the, you know, the idea of trucking it, you know, truckload after truckload after truckload forever is highly unrealistic. It's incredibly expensive. And so we don't see that as, we don't see relying on it so heavily as a good idea at all.
Jennifer Savage of the Surfrider Foundation. Also with us, the mayor of Malibu, Karen Ferrer. I wanted to bring in another city's perspective on this. This, the Northern LA County city of Malibu. Mayor Ferrer, thank you for being with us. What kinds of things Malibu doing to plan for sea level rise?
Well, we've hired a consultant to do a vulnerability assessment for us. And in fact, it's the same firm that Del Mar hired. We expect our study to be finished around October 1st of next year.
And what are your concerns about the Coastal Commission and its sort of overarching approach to dealing with sea level rise?
I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all solution. We are looking at a lot of issues. Our study will consider sea level rise scenarios and how it affects our assets, everything from critical public infrastructure to public access and recreation, water quality, private property, transportation, and we will have our study specifically looking at adaptation strategies. And we want to get public input here in the city of Malibu four preferred priorities for our strategies.
Well, and you've got sort of the, you know, the lifeline transportationally through your community is Pacific Coast Highway. And if that road is vulnerable to being covered with seawater, Malibu's existence would potentially be threatened as a connected city. So have you talked with the Coastal Commission about how to deal with the potential threat to PCH?
I have not specifically. We don't have any particular strategy or position right now. We're waiting for this study. But, you know, we have 21 miles of coastline. So we've always been highly attuned to anything involving coastal erosion and protection.
What about, we just heard from Jennifer Savage of the Surfrider Foundation, that reinforcing bluffs with concrete or other kinds of barriers, that makes beach erosion all the worse and makes it more difficult for people to visit. In some cases, you've got properties there in Malibu where that would probably be the only thing that would save those homes. Your thoughts on that?
It's similar to Del Mar, Larry. You know, we have bluff top properties and we have properties on the sand. But again, we're waiting for our study and we will be looking at the input from that study for our local coastal plan amendment process.
Have you had local meetings or is the commission study the first step and then you'll gather Malibu residents to talk about it?
Yes, exactly.
So they have something to react to. Okay.
Exactly. And we've had recent site-specific concerns, you probably realize, at Malibu Lagoon and severe erosion near the Adamson House historic site. So our discussion of things like that is what prompted our concerns and the initiation of this study.
Now, you also, of course, Malibu being a fire-prone city, your public safety officials, are they intensely involved in these conversations because of access issues and the like?
Yes.
All right. Mayor Karen Ferrer of Malibu joining us, Jennifer Savage of the Surfrider Foundation, and Eric Anderson covers the environment for NPR member station KPBS in San Diego. If you have questions about the California Coastal Commission and about where these coastal communities go from here in trying to deal with their valuable properties, we're at 866-893-KPECC. Jennifer Savage, are there ways other than just retreating from property that's eroded or flooded to deal with this that might both preserve the properties and preserve the beaches?
Sure. And I wanted to say that, you know, I appreciate the points that Mayor Ferrer brought up. And one of the things that you said early on is that the Coastal Commission considers managed retreat the best option. But I wanted to clarify that the Coastal Commission and Surfrider both consider managed retreat one of a suite of potential options. You know, we do need to look at the state as a whole because what happens one place has impact other places because of the precedent being set. But the geography is extremely different. I go up and down the state constantly and, you know, it varies dramatically from place to place. So different beaches, different areas of coast will have different solutions. And some things you can't move. For example, in the city of San Francisco, there's a wastewater treatment plant down on Slope Boulevard at the south end of Ocean Beach, which a lot of people know. And clearly you can't pick up and move the entire wastewater treatment station. So they are fortifying the area around that particular piece of infrastructure. But they're also practicing managed retreat by eliminating a portion of Great Highway there and turning it into restored bluffs with a pedestrian path. So it will not only provide better protection for the community that's inland of that area, but it will also enhance public access along the way. So that's an example where a combination of answers are being utilized. And yeah.
Sorry, I was just going to say, so you think it is appropriate to defend property that is public, that has some sort of a public infrastructure use, but not private homes?
I think that we need to evaluate what we're looking at in each particular place, and that the goal should be to maintain maximum public access to California's most valuable resource. You know, it's not just public recreation, but our economy depends on having a healthy, functioning coastline. So it's really important for all Californians that we do that pleasure and for money.
And Mayor Farrer was just talking about, I think it's the Adamson House, I hope I'm remembering the name correctly, that historic property, which is available to the public and open. And so that is a public resource, but in a low-lying, highly vulnerable area. So that presents a challenge, certainly. I want to thank you, Jennifer Savage of Surfrider, for being with us. Karen Farrer, the mayor of Malibu, and Eric Anderson of KPBS San Diego, NPR member station. Coming up, we'll talk about a new California law just signed by Governor Newsom, which allows for civil lawsuits to be filed against those who distribute what are called deep fake videos. These are videos that might show a political candidate saying something they never really said or being somewhere they never really are. What are going to be the opportunities for actually recouping damages for knowingly distributing false material like that? We'll find out back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Just last week, Governor Gavin Newsom signed a bill that prohibits the knowing distribution of altered video and audio of candidates within 60 days of election. This designed to combat so-called deep fakes, where you superimpose, let's say, a candidate in a setting or saying things that the candidate didn't actually say at a location they actually weren't, all to try and influence an election. But the question is, with the ability to pursue damages, will there really be a way of chasing down and holding accountable those who passed on these manipulated videos? Joining us is the dean of UC Berkeley School of Law and professor there, longtime Air Talk guest in his numerous stops along the way in academia, Erwin Chemerinsky. Dean Chemerinsky, a pleasure to have you with us again.
It's always my great pleasure to talk with you.
First of all, we can understand the intent of this new law. Do you think it will be possible to actually track down the people who are passing on these deep fakes and other falsified materials?
Sometimes. Computer technology is advanced in being able to track things, and sometimes it can work. Sometimes there'll be no way to know. But it's also hoped that this might deter these deepfakes from being there and really distorting our political process.
Is one of the defenses that someone who disseminates these videos might be that this is part of political debate, that the Constitution's guarantee of free speech should supersede a state's ability to try and restrict this material?
I've been on your program many times defending free speech. I'm an ardent supporter of it. But free speech isn't absolute. It's important to keep in mind that what this law does is ban the distribution of manipulated videos and pictures that maliciously aim to give someone a false impression about a political candidate's actions or words within 60 days of the election. It's important to note the exceptions that are here. It doesn't apply if there's a disclaimer saying that the words, the images, have been manipulated. It doesn't apply to news outlets that are paid to broadcast the material or reporting on a news story. What this is about is a new kind of speech that exists that really risks undermining our democratic system.
Well, and does this have to be knowing? So let's say you have some sort of a fake video maligning a candidate that is created outside the United States, but is widely disseminated by members of the public using Facebook or other social media platforms. Could those members of the public be held liable?
They could not be held liable unless they knew that it was a deep fake and then chose to circulate it. There is here what would be called in the law, a mens rea requirement, a knowledge that the person is circulating deep fakes.
Also joining us, in addition to Dean Erwin Chemerinsky of UC Berkeley School of Law, Matt Scherer, who's attorney with Littler Mendelsohn in Oregon. He's a member of the firm's Robotics, AI, and Automation Industry Group. Mr. Scherer, good to have you with us today. What are the challenges, as you see it, in actually getting judgments against these entities?
Well, the first challenge is going to just be, in some instances, figuring out who they are. Unlike with campaign literature from a century ago and, you know, pamphlets smearing a political candidate, you don't need a printing press or anything that really has a substantial physical footprint in order to spread misinformation in the digital age. And so the issue with deep fakes, as with other forms of manipulated and misinformation media in the age of social media, is just going to be figuring out where they started from in some instances. It could be in California, but on the other hand, it could also be in Nevada. It could be in Alabama. It could be in Russia. And just figuring out who created an image or a video in the first place can be challenging.
Do you think that that there is benefit in having a law like this? It might have some sort of discouraging effect on people sharing videos like this. They might think twice. Or do you think that there's a futility in it?
I wouldn't say that it's futile. I do think that there is a pretty small range of people that I would imagine would be deterred by this. I do think that that sweet spot does include, you know, somewhat unscrupulous members of the public and organizations who have a somewhat public platform. And an example of that might be Jacob Wall, the person who spread kind of a misinformation campaign about Elizabeth Warren last week and Pete Buttigieg earlier in the summer. Laws might deter someone like him from using deepfakes as a particular form of political misinformation and divert them to using other forms of misinformation. Now, is that necessarily something that is going to have a overall net positive impact on our public discourse? I'm not sure, but, you know, laws are never meant to deter the people who are most determined to engage in a wrong act. It's meant to deter people on the margins and kind of redirect their unscrupulous behavior towards other forms.
Matt, if you were called on to defend someone accused of knowingly disseminating falsified videos or images, what would your defense be?
Oh, certainly depend on the situation. As Professor Chemerinsky noted, there are a lot of exceptions built into the law. So the first thing I'd look for is whether it falls into one of those exceptions. And in a lot of cases, that's going to be a big gray area. You know, one of the exceptions is for satire and parody. And the issue is that in a lot of instances, one person's satire or parody is another person's character assassination. So that might be a defense that is available to me. But, you know, reasonable minds can often disagree when something crosses the line from kind of a legitimate expression of political satire and an illegitimate attempt to defame or injure the reputation of a candidate.
We're talking with attorney Matt Scherer with the firm Littler Mendelsohn in Oregon. Also with us, Dean Erwin Chemerinsky of UC Berkeley School of Law, where he's professor as well. He was the founding dean of UC Irvine School of Law at Duke University, professor there. We're talking with him about AB 730 signed by Governor Newsom. The bill, by the way, only is in existence. The law is only there till 2023. Erwin, do you know why there's a sunset to this?
I think it's important to try this and see if it works. And I think what the legislature had in mind is dealing with a new technology and a new statute. Let's reexamine in a few years.
All right. Let's talk with Thomas in Newport Beach. You're on Air Talk.
Hey, Larry, appreciate you bringing this to the forefront, because I actually think deepfakes are a non-issue. I think in the future, any official communique coming from a news source or the White House or any sort of information is going to have a barcode on the screen, sort of a Qstream laser that a person can scan with their smartphone and immediately verify that that is an official communique and not a deepfake. I think there's going to be official communique and non-official communique. And I think everything that is official coming from a news source or a government agency will have an image on the screen that can be instantaneously verified.
Fascinating. And how long do you think would be for that technology to be implemented?
As soon as deepfakes become a problem, so I'd say within the next 10 years.
Thomas, I appreciate it very much. Professor Chemerinsky, would that solve the problem?
It might. I think the question is, will there still be videos that are there that make it look like somebody is saying or doing something that they actually never said or did? And until we have the technology to prevent that, the point of this law is to keep the distortion of the political system from happening that such deepfakes create.
And I also wonder, you still have that sort of what's official, what's not official. Are people only going to be looking at official sources for the information that they get? Matthew Scherr, as a practical matter, your thoughts about using that sort of labeling or artificial intelligence to determine what's fake and what's not.
Right. I think that the caller's idea of having barcodes on it, that certainly would make it more difficult for somebody to pass off a deep fake as an official feed from C-SPAN of a White House press briefing or some other form of, large-scale journalistic organization or government agency putting out an official video. I think that it would make it more difficult to create a deep fake that would deceive people effectively in that sense. But we're living in an age of social media where everybody has a cell phone. Everybody has a camera on their cell phone that can take videos. And it's probably going to be a lot more difficult to create a system where the barcode is able to effectively distinguish between, a legitimate cell phone video and an illegitimate deepfake. It's just, I think that we're living in a strange and fascinating age where, in a lot of ways, our ability to create misinformation and false images is going to be not substantially more difficult than creating a real one. And so I'm actually not that confident that this won't be a non-issue within 10 years. I think that there's a very real possibility that deepfakes are going to be an issue that's going to dog our political discourse for some time to come.
Thank you both so much for being with us. That's Matt Scherer, Oregon-based attorney. Erwin Chemerinsky, UC Berkeley, Dean of the School of Law. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, we'll talk about the analysis of homeless census data to try and determine the percentage of those unhoused who are in need of psychological services or substance abuse treatment. According to the census that was done by the official LA Homeless Services Authority, it showed a fairly low level of those that are homeless dealing with mental illness. We're going to talk about what's a perhaps more realistic number when we come back. That's going to be right here on Air Talk on 89.3. I also want to alert you to our next Film Week screening at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, Saturday night, November 2nd. Blade Runner, The Final Cut, the one that Ridley Scott, the director, actually supervised. We're going to have a great post-film conversation, but get your tickets now while the good seats are still available. KPCC.org/in-person. I hope to see you Saturday night, November 2nd, Theater at Ace Hotel downtown. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Fresh Air with Terry Gross coming your way in 21 minutes. Terry will speak with countertenor Anthony Ross Costanzo. He's about to star at the Metropolitan Opera in Philip Glass's Akhenaten. He sings in a range associated with women's voices, once sung by castrati. That's Anthony Ross Costanzo with Terry Gross coming up at noon here on 89.3 KPECC. One of the challenges in trying to understand the depth and breadth of the homelessness crisis in Southern California is also understanding the needs of those who are unhoused, whether it's substance abuse treatment, whether it's mental health services, all that, of course, above and beyond shelter. One of the ways that folks try and get to that is through the annual census, which is undertaken by the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority. But the agency found in its census that only 29% of homeless Angelenos had either a mental illness or substance abuse disorder. And therefore, that means 71% did. I think most of us in our interactions daily with people who are living on the streets would seem to indicate a significantly higher percentage of people who are in need of mental health services or substance abuse treatment. Well, Los Angeles Times piece by Ben Oreskes looks at this issue and reanalyzed the data from the census. Ben, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
So what were your findings on these questions of substance abuse and mental health challenges?
Yeah, thanks for looking into this. I think that we did this, Doug Smith and I, who's the former data editor of the Los Angeles Times, and I looked at the demographic survey, which is done as part of the point in time count. And we did our own analysis of it and found that 67% of the homeless population had either a mental illness or substance abuse disorder. 46% had a mental illness, which includes post-traumatic stress, and 51% said substance abuse.
And how did you do that reanalysis? Were you looking at answers to surveys, or how'd you get to that?
Yeah. So just to step back for a sec, the point in time count, which we hear about, there's a lot of fanfare around it. It's done in January, is an estimate. And, 8,000 people fan out across the city and county and, are counting cars and tent-like structures that they see. That is taken in conjunction with a demographic questionnaire, a demographic survey that the Homeless Service Authority does. And basically, they create multipliers based on the survey that they do. We took those questionnaires, nearly 4,000 of them, and did our own analysis of it and looked at a kind of broader set of questions that they ask. And that's how we arrived at these numbers. Basically, the Homeless Service Authority takes a much narrower look at it, and we decided to do it slightly differently. And that's how we arrived at these numbers.
To me, the importance in this is it gives us a better understanding of the scope of these secondary and tertiary challenges and what the costs might be to the public to provide those services. But what do you see as the benefit?
I mean, I think that's exactly right. I think there are two parts to this. I think that, as you said in your intro, the public feels as they walk our streets like the crisis is worse. And I think that these numbers, while having biases that could mean that they're higher or lower, kind of offer another view that shouldn't be discounted. And I think that another significant point that one of your guests will make later as well is that this is a crisis of people who are living on the street, the unsheltered homeless population, which is, I think, about 75% of the county's homeless population. And there are people who are out there right now who are in deep psychological or physical distress. And I think that we hope that this data can be part of a conversation about how to help those people. Right now, we are building lots of permanent supportive housing. We are building lots of shelters, but a lot of that is not online yet. And even when it is, it probably will not be able to satisfy the needs of the population that's out there right now. So I think that in our view, this data is essential to any conversation policymakers have about how to best kind of rectify or address the crisis on our streets.
Ben, this unsheltered subset of homeless Angelenos, does that include people that are living in their cars, or is that considered to be sheltered?
I believe it does include those people. The Homeless Service Authority does break out the numbers about people who are living in cars and RVs, but this, I think, mostly looks at people who are intense.
Okay. And so you're using the same definition as Lhasa is for unsheltered.
Yes, we are. Where our sort of analysis differs from theirs is on the survey, there are two questions that you need to answer to sort of be counted as having a substance abuse condition or a mental health condition or a health condition. The first is, do you have this or don't you have this? The second is, have you had this for longer than 18 months? If you say no to the second question, they don't count you. There's a reason they do that. It has to do with the federal definition of chronic homelessness. And the reason for that is they want, when this information is reported to the federal government, they want to be able to compare apples to apples. So if you're looking at LA and you're looking at San Francisco, you could have the same definition for the same thing. But in the course of doing that, it does offer a much narrower snapshot. So what our analysis does is look at people who may have said yes or no to that, and then also looked at some other questions on the survey, ones that had to do with whether or not the person who was asking the questions observed you to have one of these conditions and one other one. But that was the kind of major thing that had been excluded by the homeless service.
Okay. And so just to clarify, you are including people that live in cars as unsheltered.
Yes.
You are. Okay. Also with us is Sarah Dusso, who's chair of the L.A. Homeless Services Authority, which does that point-in-time census of unhoused Angelenos. Ms. Dusso, thank you for being with us. Yes, you look at the Times analysis. There anything that you would take issue with the criteria they use to look at mental illness and substance abuse?
Well, I think it's been stated that they just simply looked at a broader brush. The Lhasa's point-in-time numbers simply are, you know, complying with the federal standards on how you're supposed to report. And this is, you know, so that we can compare across jurisdictions and nationally. And they took a deeper dive into the responses to the demographic survey, which is a small percentage of the overall count. A small percentage engage in a conversation with outreach workers and then self-report on these questions. And they took a deeper dive on that and added to the percentage folks who did not check the box of long-term, as Ben stated, and then folks who the person doing the questionnaire, which is simply a volunteer, they could add an observation. So I think that every analysis has aspects of it that skew upward or downward, making one group appear more vulnerable or less vulnerable. But it just doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that the man-made affordable housing crisis is disproportionately affecting our most vulnerable, and that living on the streets worsens health conditions, whatever those conditions.
Yeah, well, it's a chicken and egg phenomenon, right? Because if someone already is dealing with post-traumatic stress or a mental health challenge, living on the streets would only exacerbate it.
Right.
Also, Sarah, one of the things when I saw the original Lhasa number of 29% dealing with mental illness or substance abuse, I thought part of that could be because you do have a certain percentage of the homeless population that we really don't see on the street, that they're, you know, often we don't see the families or the women to the degree that we do the men, and yet we know that there are thousands of them out there, but maybe they're in, you know, formal shelters or other places. So does that affect our perception?
Oh, 100%. I mean, that absolutely affects perception around this issue. But I just want to be clear that, you know, the commission is very interested in looking more at a variety of data points and looking more at exactly what people who are unsheltered need in order to make sure we can house people quickly, but also just expand access to mental health care and health care. And I've been part of the delegation that was reported in the LA Times that just came back from Italy. It's called Heart Forward LA, which is working to revolutionize access to mental health care in LA County. And we strongly support that, you know, we need to really focus on how we're looking at the needs of people first. But that, even that in mind, we don't want to, you know, each of these different data sets can skew, you know, the way we look at things. And the affordable housing crisis is certainly one very important element. Our lack of mental health care, our lack of health care in general, is another very important element as well. It's a humanitarian crisis that hits us on many different levels.
We're talking with Sarah Dussault, who's chair of the L.A. Homeless Services Authority, known as LASA. Coming up, we'll talk with Janie Roundtree of the California Policy Lab at UCLA. They just yesterday released a new report on homelessness. You're listening to Where Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in just 1 minute. We're talking about the challenges of homeless Angelenos. The Los Angeles Times conducted a new analysis of the point-in-time census conducted under the auspices of the L.A. Homeless Services Authority and found a significantly higher percentage of homeless Angelenos who have mental health challenges as well as are dealing with substance abuse. The L.A. Times figure of 67%, two-thirds of those who are in this unhoused cohort who need assistance because of some degree of disabling mental illness or drug abuse. With us is Janie Roundtree of UCLA's California Policy Lab, who just released a study on this. And their study found 50% of unsheltered people reported they suffer from a combination of physical health condition, mental health issue, and a substance abuse condition, what is called trimorbidity. That's half. Janie Roundtree, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it. How did you conduct this assessment?
Well, thank you so much for having us on. The California Policy Lab is a relatively new research center at UCLA that partners with LASA and other public agencies to do data analysis on homelessness, among other issues. And it's led by Professor Tilvon Wachter, who's the Associate Dean of the Department of Economics. So you've asked a great question, and I did want to describe the study a little bit because we're looking at different data than what the prior two guests described. So specifically, we're looking at a national data set of nearly 70,000 surveys, and these are surveys that are given by providers or social workers who are in the field when they interact with sheltered individuals or unsheltered individuals. And unlike the demographic survey that was described previously, these surveys are really designed to prioritize people for housing. And so the questions are about, do you have a mental health, physical health, substance abuse condition that you're suffering from and that is also a cause of your most recent homeless spell or a cause of housing instability in your life? And so what we did was look at the responses among unsheltered individuals and compare them to responses among sheltered individuals and saw quite stark differences between these two groups, and specifically that individuals who are living on the street are much more likely to be suffering from health, mental health, substance abuse concerns. They're more likely to report those as the cause of their homelessness, and they're less likely to be accessing emergency shelters and more likely to be on the street for longer periods of time.
And do we know if the major factor for them not being in a shelter, aside from many cities, a lack of available beds, but is part of this also that because of their mental health state or drugs that they're using, it makes them difficult for them to be in close quarters with other people?
We don't know that for sure based on the data that we have, but I think that's a common sense theory for why that might be, and certainly something that we need to pay more attention to, specifically whether our most vulnerable people who are affected by the housing market conditions are able to access shelter that's appropriate for them. And I did want to say one really striking point about our study, which is not just the difference between unsheltered individuals and sheltered individuals, but the difference between men and women living on the street. We saw twice as many women report abuse or trauma as the reason for their homelessness as men who are living on the street. So I think it's really important to ask ourselves whether the emergency housing we're providing is suitable for people with those specific needs.
And one of the things I keep returning to is if we're able to create significant new numbers of shelter beds, you're still going to have a certain percentage of homeless Angelenos who are not going to want to be in a shelter. They're going to prefer to be outside, finding that a better alternative than being sheltered. And potentially, if you have enough shelter beds to handle everybody, then it would enable cities to be able to move unsheltered people off the streets if there's an alternative. But I wonder what happens to those individuals who don't want to be in a shelter, then if they're not allowed to be on the street. Where would, you know, in the past, those people might have been jailed. But I think there's not an appetite to do that now. So then what becomes of them?
Well, I have two responses. I think my first response is that everyone working on homelessness, to my knowledge, in Los Angeles agrees that we have to house people first and then treat their conditions. So it's the housing first model, which means provide housing that isn't preconditioned on someone showing good health or compliance with their treatment. That's what the city is working towards, what the county is working towards, and it remains the best solution and one that we should all be focused on supporting in any way that we can. I think the other point that I wanted to make is that prevention is extremely important. So there is a group of people who are ill whose illness appears to be the cause of their homelessness, and I think we have to ask ourselves whether they're adequately accessing mental health or health care before they experience their homeless crisis? And is there an opportunity to keep more people in housing if we connect them more quickly to services on the front end?
We're talking with Janie Rountree, joining us from the UCLA California Policy Lab. She's the founding executive director and the co-author of this national report on homelessness that was released yesterday. Did you see regional differences? High housing prices are said to be a significant driver of homelessness here in Southern California. But I wonder if in places where housing is less expensive, you are seeing a different composition of the homeless population.
Interestingly, we did not see regional differences in our data. We compared the responses, for example, of unsheltered individuals who are living on the West Coast to the East Coast, to the South, to the Southwest, to the Midwest, and they were pretty consistent. And in fact, for those of you who are listening who are interested in the details, we do have a technical report available on our website that will show you the detailed tables, including the regional comparisons.
All right. I want to thank you all for being with us. That's Janie Rountree from California Policy Lab, Sarah Dussault of the L.A. Homeless Services Authority. She's the chair of the organization, and Los Angeles Times staff writer who covers homelessness and housing, Ben Oreskes. Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk. You can, of course, share your comments about any of the segments that we have, because a vital conversation online usually takes off after our segments. You can be a part of it, too. If you've never visited one of our Air Talk segment pages, maybe today, the day you can do that and take part in an online conversation, kpecc.org. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up next. Her guest is countertenor Anthony Ross Costanzo, starring in Philip Glass's Akhenaten at the Metropolitan Opera. And Anthony sings in the range associated with women's voices. Have a great day. Back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next Air Talk on KPCC.